Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, number 466. It's a hostful intro!
Boo!
What? What's wrong, little Matt Myra?
I don't remember this episode.
Well, you weren't
the
in
one
it.
That we did.
It's Neil Brennan.
Is this a hostful intro for the hostful episode?
No, it's a hostful intro for Neil Brennan episode, because we all weren't there, because Matt's been working on At Midnight.
Yeah.
That's true.
So it's tough to get him out of the office.
Love that Neil Brennan.
I promise more hostfuls in the future, though. We just recorded one that's going to be up Friday.
Yeah.
I kind of like this regular schedule we have, and so we'll have some more hostfuls up. Neil Brennan actually is going to be on At Midnight tonight, January 15th, with Nikki Glaser and Ron Funches. So
tune
you should
in.
Watch At Midnight.
Who wants Skittles?
Tune in for some
Skittles?
Goth Confessions.
Are we doing Goth Confessions?
Maybe that's Thursday.
Okay, good.
Confession Bear.
Sometime this week, we'll play the games. Are you having a nice time on the At Midnight show?
Yeah, it's great. I get my scripts confused because we run two of them tomorrow that I forgot that I...
Oh, this insider talk is boring.
Anyway, I love At Midnight. It's a lot of fun. Everyone should be watching it.
I just want everyone to feel included.
Oh.
Howard, what are you doing with your days?
Oh, God. It's nothing.
you love it?
Jonah's living the life we all dreamed about living.
Yeah. I'm taking these opportunities to just have a nice time.
Nice.
Yeah.
Before you, because you're going to get busy soon.
Yeah, I'll get busy. And I'm doing stuff, going on auditions and writing with Sean O'Connor on some ideas.
Oh, nice.
And stuff like that. Yeah. I'm doing stuff, but you know, it's for the most part, that stuff is fun, so it doesn't feel like I'm doing anything.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm making the process an enjoyable one.
Nice. Well, you're all smiles. I always appreciate that.
It really is. It's kind of ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. I got really into Percocet.
Just really.
Just really. Just everything's fucking
Oh, the
great.
Air is so soupy. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by IFC Spoils of Babylon. Do you guys, you're familiar with the legendary author Eric John Rosch, right?
Yes, of course, yes. I see his stuff all over at all the...
Do you have any connections to get him on the show?
Pasternak?
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible.
Do you think Dan could get him on the show for us?
I think so.
Because it'd be a really big... I mean, really, the only way that I've been able to get the John Rosch fix is to watch him on the small screen in The Spoils of Babylon. On IFC, it's a miniseries.
I know he looks like he looks a lot like Will Ferrell.
Yeah, I mean, I know he gets
like,
that
he looks a lot like
a lot of times, but he's way more famous than Will.
Yeah.
Like people always think Will is Eric John Rosch.
Well, it's him, Will Ferrell, and the drummer of Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah. Well, Spoils of Babylon is on Thursdays. It's not just Eric John Rosch. I know that's the only reason you think you're going to be watching, but then you'll also get Kristen Wiig, Tobey Maguire, Will Ferrell. I think it's kind of funny to have them in the same.
It's funny.
It's crazy.
Jessica Alba, Val Kilmer, Haley Joel Osment, Tim Robbins, Michael Sheen.
So what you're saying is like it sounds like the Funny or Die machine came out in force for this program.
They really, really did. Yeah. Well, Eric John Rosch has a lot of pull at FOD.
Yeah.
Which is a company that that we are intimately familiar with.
Yeah,
from
I feel
At Midnight.
Like we should have some pull over there too.
Yeah, well, we'll give it a shot. We'll give it a shot. So we'll try to get Eric John Rosch on, but in the interim, watch The Spoils of Babylon on IFC on Thursdays. And thanks to IFC for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Neil Brennan was this guest who, God, I've known Neil. Neil's a writer on Singled Out, which we go into on the show, and we've never had a long conversation, like a really, really long conversation before. And so some of the times I was like, I don't know if Neil likes me or not. I don't know if we're... And he was great on the podcast. Like, really insightful and so...
Good dude.
Just, I mean, you know, he's, you know, he wrote for years with Chappelle, and he writes for Chris Rock, and he writes... I mean, he's... And now he has his own stand-up that he's been doing. He's like kind of he for a long time he was the guy behind the guy, like one of the guys behind the guys. But now he has his own Comedy Central special called Women and Black Dudes, and it's airing January 18th at midnight on Comedy Central. So
So like if you need your midnight comedy fix, then we're not on that night.
Then you got Neil Brennan on January 18th. And also right now here on the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 466.
Slash WTF.
Why slash WTF? Because you couldn't do it in the sponsor bit?
Just in case.
But slash WTF what?
It's just exactly. It's the beauty of it.
You're like the WTF subreddit for this podcast.
Yeah, did you hear his Johnny Knoxville interview? It's great.
No.
I think. I don't know. It might come out tomorrow. I don't know.
I'm sure it actually is really good.
Weeks?
Yeah, it's been out for a while. It's really good.
All right, you're not the moderator of the WTF subreddit anymore.
I guess I lost my...
You think of the fact that Johnny Knoxville was just shot apart in the Marin show on
That's what I was thinking of, guys. Oh, my God. I'll go back to moderating Gone Wild Curvy.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
How you doing, Chris?
I'm good. How are you doing, Neil Brennan?
Good, buddy. Chris Hardwick has always called me by my full name, and hopefully never will stop.
Neil Brennan. I don't know. I just...
I know. I get... You always have.
All set.
We'll save it for the...
We're on.
This is it.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
On my phone, in my schedule, either there was an autocorrect of what this was... I don't know what it, or I typed in it wrong, but it sounds like a dorky R&B group.
Which one?
Nerdacy.
Nerdacy.
That's what it was.
That's a character. It's like like a guy singing Jodeci songs about Star
Nerdacy.
Wars.
It's like the Neil Hamburger of R&B.
but I hear Morrissey in that.
Oh, that's
like Smith. Nerdacy.
That's
funny.
That's even more nerdy. That you heard Morrissey and didn't think
girlfriend on an Xbox on her.
I never got into Morrissey or The Cure, and I was talking to somebody about that last night. It just totally skipped me.
Passed by you?
Yeah, because I had nothing but older brothers and sisters, so I graduated immediately to classic rock.
Oh, you went right to
anything that was current. I didn't. Yeah, meant nothing to me. And then and then I got to college. I was like, what? Like goth? It skipped me.
And so, so you never went through the period of eyeliner?
What you just did.
it was way outside.
I didn't, what was he just doing?
A Morrissey impression.
Went right to AC/DC and Journey and Van Halen.
Fucking absolutely. I was thinking about a Boston song yesterday in the shower.
Which one?
It was a People Living in Competition. Because I was thinking about, that's a real meditation on consumerism and capitalism in general. That was my thought process in the shower yesterday.
Wow.
And I meant to look up the lyrics. So I was like, that's pretty for the late 70s.
I love that they just named themselves after a city. Because that's a bold move. Because if you're a shitty band, you name it, then the city's like, fuck you. And they even say in one of those songs, we were just another man out of Boston. And they're called Boston.
Especially they were out of themselves. Aerosmith.
I always wanted Boston and Kansas to fight.
Well, there's Boston, Kansas, Chicago, Asia, America.
The presidents of the United States of America.
There's them, too.
Antarctica. No Antarctica.
Not one Antarctica.
There was an Africa, right?
There was Toto did a song called Africa.
Europe.
No one would call themselves
Europe.
Florida.
There was a Europe, right?
There was Europe. Yeah, the final countdown.
Yeah.
That's Australia,
a continent. That's fucking going crazy.
Well, so is Asia. Someone should have been Eurasia, and they should have mixed members of each band.
I'm smelling mashup.
What?
I'm going to get in a time machine.
I'm going to
go back to 8 years ago, and I smell mashup. And when I smell mashup, I got to go make it.
Get girl talk on the phone.
Mash?
All right, 8 years ago, Jonah. What are you talking about?
Get girl talk on the telegraph.
When he was. Girl talk was. That's hard to. Girl talk, you think you're going to. It's going to be great. I've downloaded Girl Talk Records. And then you're like, oh, this is going to be the best. And then 15 seconds in, you're like, God damn it, this is aggravating.
It's not for listening. It's for putting on in the background.
That's so funny you say that.
That's what it's for.
I hear it in a store and I go, fuck, I gotta download this when I get home. And then I listen to it on the computer and I'm like,
not for listening.
You're like,
it's for having there. It's bed
I
music.
Was listening to it one time and a girl I was dating goes, this sounds like something I would cheerlead to.
Ooh.
I was like, yeah, you're absolutely, like, it was guilty as charged. I couldn't. Yeah.
I always thought that the Hood Internet, these guys from Chicago, did a better version of what Girl Talk was doing. It was like they would just take like a current hip hop or R&B song and then like a current kind of indie rock song and put it together, never over a minute and a half, real quick and easy.
And that was
Then they just make mixes and then they just put those out for free.
Yeah, I liked Holertronics. That was guys. I'm going pretty deep on that one. Don't worry.
You like Fatboy Slim?
What?
Is he like Fatboy Slim?
Fatboy Slim? I've never heard it pronounced like that.
Is that Fatboy Slim?
Fatboy Slim is fucking
Hardwick,
in heaven.
I got some questions for you.
Yes.
I want to know about your stopping drink. I'm sure you've covered it other places, but I'm very interested in it.
Well, one day I decided that I drink too much, so I stopped drinking.
Literally, and you just stopped?
Truthfully, it had been sort of, I guess for the last few years of it, there was something in the back of my head that was like, you know, you'll probably have to not do this anymore someday. Like, I was aware that it was, and I would sort of joke like, oh yeah, this, I am really drinking a lot. Or I would wake up in the morning really hungover and then catch myself in the mirror drinking a beer so I could level out and fall back asleep. And then just kind of laugh and like, buddy, this is really not going to, this is not a good long-term plan.
Did you like that identity of the drunken Lothario?
I did for a while. Because it's fun. It's fun when you're late 20s. It's fun in your 20s to sort of be that guy. Like, I can drink more than anybody. Yeah. I'm fun. I'm a party. I'm a mobile party. And then at a certain point when you realize you don't have any money and no job prospects and you're fatter than you were a few years ago and people are weird to you and then you start to realize it's you and not them.
Yeah.
Then, you know, and what really kind of did it was I was dating this girl named Andrea Savage who just did At Midnight the other night. And Andrea Savage
is fucking hilarious.
She's great.
I see her at audition sometimes.
She's great. She's really funny. And she said, we'd been dating for a little over a year and she was like, look, I'm not saying you have to quit drinking, but I'm saying there's a reason that you're doing it and you should really probably figure out why that is. And so I said, all right.
Fire. And the reason was you fucking love to party.
I mean, yeah.
Get out of my face,
that's
lady.
That's what I'm talking about.
Number one,
fucking love to party.
Number one, fun. Number two, see number one.
Yeah.
Number three, forever.
Get out of my face and into my bar.
So I started seeing a therapist who was this woman that was I started seeing her. She was recommended to be my Moon Zappa recommended her. Said she, you know, she's a friend of mine and she's really great. And it was this woman who had been on SNL named Pamela Stevenson.
Oh yeah.
And Pamela is married to Billy Connolly. And so I was like, I immediately was like, I have to see this woman. She's
as a fan.
The first session was just all talking about Jackie Rogers Jr.'s $100,000 jackpot.
Was she in that one?
Yes, she played his wife.
Was she in Chocolate Babies?
She was in Chocolate Babies.
Fuck.
She played Angelique, Jackie's wife.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she had played Joan Collins, and she did all these great... And she was in History of the World Part 1. And so I was like, oh, not only is she a comic, she's married to a comic. She's going to understand how my brain works.
Well, you know what's interesting, if I can interject, is becoming a therapist is the only thing that when you quit doing comedy... people don't judge you for. You're not a failure.
No.
You do anything else, you fail at comedy.
Because you didn't keep doing comedy.
Yeah, if you go into therapy, it's like you just fucking... You graduated.
Yeah, I had a therapist that used to be a comic.
Yeah.
And it was great because I would be like, what was... When you were performing with Jerry Seinfeld... what did he do?
A lot of what you're doing on stage is a form of... can be a form of therapy depending on what kind of style you have. And so I was seeing this woman for a while and then finally, you know, one day I showed up and you don't realize that when you're doing it that you smell and you look bad. And so she just said, she just looked at me and she goes, I mean, it was one of the realest moments that I've ever had. She just looked at me and she goes, and like, it wasn't therapy. Like, tell me what you, she just looked at me and she goes, you look terrible. What are you doing?
Yeah.
You need to stop this right now. You need to go to rehab today if you can. But this is just not good. And I didn't have the presence of mind. I was like, oh, I thought I looked okay. I just didn't know.
Yeah.
And it was just the right time that my brain went, oh, yeah, I guess I could. Because I hadn't said, Friday, I'm going to quit. It's going to be Friday. All right. Okay, next Friday.
Yeah.
It was just in a moment she said, you shouldn't do this anymore. And I was like, I think you're right. I think I should just not do this anymore. And so that was it. I stopped. After that, I never drank again after
that.
Did
you go to rehab or anything?
I tried to go to rehab, but
they said no, no, no.
God damn it.
Sorry.
God, it's not everything's a fucking episode of Matt Midnight.
Points!
You're not going to get any points for that.
I give you points.
Yeah. That's funny. If anyone can give it, it's
I mean, the points have the same true. Value here they have on the show.
What else am I going to do? Join in about not drinking? Can't do that.
Come on.
sit quietly and think about yourself. yeah, I tried to go to rehab, but the insurance took... funny, the insurance actually was my rehab. The insurance took a couple days to deal with the rehab facility, and so by that time it had been like 3 or 4 days, and I was like, I think this was the 3 or 4 days I was supposed to be in rehab. I didn't drink, so I think I just don't need to go to rehab
and
now.
Was it, did you do anything else in those 3 days? Was it like fucking train spotting?
No. Oh, yeah.
No,
yeah,
it was
gearing up for rehab. Yeah,
I know somebody that got they were quitting like drugs and shit, and she said that when she was kicking, she thought she was gonna think herself to death.
Oh,
which was such a great description of like mania and obsession,
but also a reason why a lot of people will take substances to just like quiet the chatter. And, at that point, it was still like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to do this. I'm just kind of experimenting. Well, let's just see how long I can not do it. And I went to a couple AA meetings, and then I talked to a couple guys like Greg Barrett and, you know, who were very supportive. And I was like, you know, I think I'm going to give this a shot. And then that was it. And then I started to feel better pretty quickly, which was motivating to stop, you know, to just keep going with it.
Did you exercise or anything?
I didn't start exercising until 2005, but I dropped a ton of weight like within a month.
Yeah,
within a month, 6 weeks. I mean, a lot.
Do you remember that joke that you had when Andrea was leaving you? Do you remember that joke you said on stage?
No.
It was it's like so my girlfriend was leaving and she had her backpack, but she was ready to go, and then she said goodbye to me. And then she said goodbye to the dog, and she started crying. And then you said, you're going to cry when you say goodbye to the dog, you're not going to cry when you say goodbye to me. And then she said, well, the dog doesn't come home wasted every night.
Oh, wow. I said that on stage?
About the Bruco, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Goddamn, the Bruco.
Yeah.
The Bruco. I can't believe that.
Yeah. It's a good joke.
What? I don't know if that was a good joke. I think that was just a, oh, no.
Blew the roof off the place, Chris.
Look, Chris, you can't argue with the crowd, buddy. It's a hot joke.
They know what they want. I totally forgot about that. She, I quit drinking, and then a day later we broke up, and I was like, yeah, but I quit drinking, and she was like, yeah, but you kind of salted the earth. Like, it was already at that point she had just had enough, and she was right, and I don't blame her.
What's crazy? She's married and has kids now.
Yeah, she has
a
kid. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
You've never had. I don't know if you've ever had that happen where you like dating a girl. And then you break up, and then she goes on, gets married, and have kids. And
most
like,
of my ex-girlfriends, except for Janet, have kids. I think, as far as I know, all of them now have kids.
Yeah.
I don't find it weird. I don't find it like that could have been me. I just find it like, oh, like you were serious.
or they met, you know, they just met the guy that they, you know.
You were an obstruction to... the best part of her life.
Yeah, their happiness. You just get in the way of everyone's happiness.
You make jokes, but I have felt that way in the past. I definitely felt that way
like,
in the past.
Like you do the breakup of like, I'm saving you from something worse?
Well, on some level, or just kind of realizing like, oh yeah, I'm the turd in the punch bowl that is, you know, like is keeping, that is potentially
sounds like a crazy party.
Whoa, this guy drank a lot.
No, it was just sparkling apple juice.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which makes it grosser for some reason.
Yeah, that is worse.
If someone shits in a punch bowl, people at a sober party.
Yeah. That's yeah, then they've got a problem because they don't have an excuse.
Yeah, there's no excuse.
I wish you were
just
drunk.
Their kink.
I wish you had an excuse.
So do I.
And then it's been, that's almost 10 years, I would think?
It's been over 10 years, yeah.
Wow.
And there were periods in the beginning where it was tough because the first year you quit, you're not used to dealing with emotions. And so it's almost like gaining a new sense that you're hearing it for the first time, or you're just not accustomed to feeling the things. So things come in and you're like, how do I deal with, oh, I just have to let it pass, you know? Yeah. And then once you get comfortable with that, then you're okay.
Why do you ask?
Because I don't know the story. I just heard that you quit drinking, and I've never heard. I don't know that I've never heard.
It's a particularly great story.
No, they're always pretty interesting.
It was something that had been building for a long time, and it was so a part of my identity. And I had kind of, there's a thing where some people think like I have to get high or I have to drink to be funny on stage. But I had found that I would stand on stage and my mind would be blank. And so near the end of it, so I just was like, I don't know. I think maybe that's just something I tell myself so I don't have to quit drinking.
Right.
And and then, of course, after I quit, it was the opposite, which was my set got better.
Here's my other line of questioning, which is I was talking to Moshe Kasher, who was on at midnight the other night, and we were talking about how good you are at that job in particular and how good you are just in general. And I'm wondering, is that like a practice thing? You've always been a good host. That's what I'm like. Do you think it's a personality thing? Do you think it's a metabolism thing? Do you think it's like an ADD thing? What do you think it is?
Well, I don't. Well, first, I really, that's very sweet, and I appreciate that because what we'll go on to talk about is how we met when you were writing on Singled Out.
The good stuff, the red meat.
The good days.
What the kids are here for.
Yeah.
There we were.
And then what we'll
Burbank, Victory Boulevard.
Medius, that whole area is just like a giant fucking mega mall.
Is it really?
Now, yeah.
I was wondering what happened in that place.
That studio's still there, but across, because our Nerdist studio is right next to Empire.
Oh, okay, good.
And so now there's this massive. There's like a Lowe's and like a Best Buy and like
where
50
is it?
Restaurants. It's
like
it's in Burbank.
Victory and what?
And Victory and Burbank Boulevard. Victory and Burbank Boulevard near that, and then like right by the Five.
Yeah.
Empire Avenue. It's Empire Studios. It's still there, but I don't know. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think to be a host, you have to be a little bit of a control freak, but not so much that you completely suck the, you know, like try to rip control away from everyone.
Right.
You just kind of have to. It's just like friendly traffic copping.
Right.
I don't know.
Do you think, do you find yourself being like that offstage?
Not really. I mean, I don't go into a room and I'm like, okay, you over there.
But I'm like at a party. Are you like?
No, I'm actually pretty. I mean, if I know people, I'll be just like any other comic, you know, like, oh, it's a riff pile. But actually, at parties, I'm pretty quiet and I don't like to draw a lot of attention.
You should drink.
it's a lot of fun.
To totally loosen all that stuff up.
Yeah, the life of the party. Chris.
You're gonna love what you're at. Does to your
people,
act.
People
as well.
Would actually like you.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
And really here's good. The other thing, Chris. You won't feel a thing.
Oh, that's fantastic.
No feeling.
You won't remember anything.
It is great.
Who's thirsty?
Andrea wants to come back. I heard.
What?
Andrea wants to leave her husband and children and come and be with you.
Yeah. What is this? The Burn? No, but you and I met
it's
on.
It's a weird version of The Burn. Yeah. Really personal.
Yeah, it's a deeply psychological.
It reminds me of Eddie Pepitone's like really personal heckler bit.
Oh yeah.
Why do you dream about red birds attacking you at night?
Yeah, that's hilarious.
I met you on Singled Out.
1994?
95.
It was 95.
95.
Was it really?
Yeah, we did the pilot at the end of 94, and the show got picked up in 95.
I was on the pilot as well.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah. So that was August of 94, and then in 95 we did those spring break episodes at Lake Havasu.
Well, I was not allowed to go to Havasu.
Because you were not
underage?
You were underage.
I actually was underage.
You were like 19 or 20
I was very young. I might have, I was underage.
But you were always, I mean, it was obvious to me, you can tell when you meet people like, the guy's a little extra funny for his age. He's funnier than people at his age. Like you had that comedy thing, but there was also kind of a cockiness with it as well.
Yeah,
because you knew I felt like you knew that you were funnier than everyone else.
Also, very insecure.
You think so?
Well, it's secretly. I had red birds were attacking me at night. yeah, I never thought. I mean, I was like happy to be doing stuff, but it showbiz, like, you know, gets it humbles you soon enough.
Yeah.
Over and over. And then you get cocky and it's like, slow down.
Yeah.
And then you get
cocky
and then sit down.
Yeah.
That's why I love when people, like, we've been doing, like, when people are talking about showbiz, I want to go like, I've been doing this for 20 years. You've no idea how fucking long that is.
It's a really long time to have experience doing this very weird thing that's not that applicable to any other profession.
Yeah. But also the cycles of it is what I find, like, oh, he'll be gone.
Well, that's why it's good to have success later on, so that you know, when Singled Out, I'm sure I was the same way. You know, I was pretty insecure on that show because I just didn't really, I don't know, I wasn't fully comfortable. I had my little corner of the show, but still, the rest of it was just frat guys and sorority girls and you know, and I was, the whole thing was fun, but I still, I mean, I still was a little like, this is weird. You know,
I was really pushy too. I remember your impression of me was like doing a joke and then you'd like lean in. Like, you fucking, that was your impression of me in 1995.
But they were, the lean in was, if someone else did a joke, it was your way of kind of like, oh
someone's got a joke, do we?
Yeah.
So, that's
say,
true.
So just say a joke.
It's really putting me on the spot here, Chris.
And it's sort of off-putting because you're like right there.
Yeah, I'd like
there.
Lean in.
It sort of
like,
punctuates.
Oh yeah, are you
going to do a joke there?
Do you do it when they start the joke? You start.
No, you wait. He waits for the punch.
No, I wait and I'd be like, mm-hmm. I'd sort of just do a, like a little lean in, like whoa.
That's really aggressive.
It was very, but I was very aggressive. Yeah. And then I left to write for all that on Nickelodeon.
Did you really? I didn't know you left for
yeah, I left for all that.
That's fantastic.
And then I worked for Kenan and Kel.
Oh, that's right. You worked with Dan. You worked with Dan Schneider.
Yep. Dan Schneider, who the only time I've been to a gun range was with Dan Schneider. I haven't seen him in 17 years.
I saw Dan like a year ago. We had lunch.
Did you really?
Yeah, every couple years we'll get together and have lunch.
It's crazy how you can live, like, we're all, if you did that like Robert Altman thing of like the people passing,
yeah,
like how many times I've probably driven past them or whatever, like all these people, and you just never see them
because what we tend to do in our lives is create this habit trail, and we just go to the same five places.
Yeah,
here, home, that place, home, there for dinner, home, and it's very rare. I mean, at least for me, I don't deviate a lot from that, from those patterns, and so it's very unlikely that I run into people that don't live on that
path. Yeah, I never bump. In fact, when I lived in New York, I lived in Midtown because I didn't want to bump into people, and I never did. I bumped into Greg Giraldo the day he got out of rehab.
Oh shit!
Yeah. So that was the only person. That's how bad it had to be for you to bump into me.
You had to be coming out of rehab.
That's how off your cycle you had to be.
So you, what were you like in high school?
I was probably like the same, but my brother was a comedian, so I used to go to New York all the time and hang out in clubs. So I knew all those, like I knew Attell in high school, I knew John Stewart in high school, I knew Romano in high school. And
holy shit.
And like, so I was sort of that world. That's why when I was able to, like, then I worked the door in New York at a club, and then when I moved out here, I was sort of like, a lot of that thing when you're that age, a lot of it's sort of borrowed. Like, a lot of your sort of like voice is borrowed.
Of course.
Is this your personality and social situation?
You're just you're forming, you're absorbing, and you're, but boy, that's so fucking amazing, because for people like, For me, the absorbing comedy was absorbing just every comedy special and every album.
Yeah.
Like, absorbing all of the A-list polished material sets, but to actually absorb what real, like, in the trenches
late
comedy
night spots.
Is, like,
I used to do a thing in high school with my friends where if somebody said something there was like, it was in my group of friends, I'd be like, I wrote that. And they were like, no, I wrote that. These guys are now working like insurance and shit. And we were fighting over who wrote what like yeah. car bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like yeah. driving to go drink
yeah.
bit.
Were you doing stand-up at that?
No, I didn't start. Here's the thing about stand-up. I never did stand-up. When I was working on those shows, when people would always go like, you seem like more of a, like you're more than a writer. They were sort of like, you're pretty annoying for a writer.
Writers are quieter.
Like, writers tend to have more like deeper self-hatred. And,
your head's not down that often. Yeah, you're not hunched over.
You got good posture. What's wrong with you? So I didn't start doing stand-up till like 6 years ago. Because I did it a little bit during Chappelle's show. I was just around it. I should have been doing it. Because I'd go to the Laugh Factory all the time. I'd hang out with Chappelle. I'd hang out with Jay Moore. I'd hang out with all these guys. And I was just like, no, you guys go ahead. I don't need the attention.
Yeah.
And then finally I was like, you know what, guys? Turns out I totally need it. In fact, may need it worse than you guys.
Because it's been building up all these
because
years.
Because at least you guys started when you were in your high school. And I've been like stewing in my own broth.
Do you always feel that idea of just like, it's like, I should have started sooner. I should have... Because I have that sometimes, and I started pretty young, and I still have that, like, if I should have gone out
a year earlier. I can cure you of that after he answers.
All right.
Then it's like, so what, should I have not done Chappelle? You know what I mean? Like,
do you think that would have changed?
I think it would have changed the space-time continuum.
You are on Nerdacy.
No, it's true.
Yo, I'm high on Nerdacy right now.
You guys got some Nerdacy. He's right. If anything had changed, it would. And this is why how I will cure you of that, because I didn't start doing as much as I had been obsessed with comedy my whole life. Single Now came along, and so I didn't feel as pressing a need to like to just jump into stand up. Even though I wanted to do it, it still scared the fuck out of me.
You said you did it a little bit. I remember
in college. Yeah, yeah. I was in a group, and we would do stand up in the dorms every quarter or so, and I branched out and did a couple of the right when the alternative, like the uncabaret scene, was starting to boom a little bit. But I also, when I look back, I think. At the time that I started doing comedy, if I had really pursued stand-up right out of, like, if I had left college to go do stand-up, I feel like I would have turned out to be a much different comic. Like, I really needed all of the influence of the scene that I fell into to become, like, I could have just been like a road comic doing road gags. Yeah. And
I should say I did it once when I was 18, once when I was 23. 18 was horrible. And I'm pretty sure Louie and Sarah were there in the room because they were both like in New York. And 23 was good. And then I did a little bit when I was like 29. And then it's the worst way to do it. And then I started again when I was like 33 or 34.
I was 27 when I started doing, when I really said, I'm really going to finally pursue this. I'm really going to finally this. I really, really need to do it.
And did people like think you were that TV guy or something?
A lot of people did. You know, people like Maron would be like, what are you fucking doing?
That's surprising.
I mean, what most people didn't know about me was that I had always wanted to do stand up. And it wasn't like, I think outwardly it sort of looked like, oh, this TV guy wants to try stand-up because he thinks it's easy.
Yeah.
Not knowing that I had seen every comedy special.
Yeah.
And that was my obsession, my real, real obsession. And so by the time I was ready to start it, I had singled out, had come and gone. And so I was a guy who had been on a popular TV show. But
Did you end up making any money off that?
No. Off Singled Out?
Yeah.
No.
Never?
Not even later? No, because there were no residuals or anything.
Right.
But
you couldn't get your, like, episodic, you couldn't get bumps?
I mean, I did get a bump, but it wasn't enough to, I couldn't do anything else. And so I guess I think it probably worked out to maybe, like, I would take home, I don't know, like, maybe, like, 40 grand a year or something.
Yeah.
Like, it was not, I would always say, like, oh, it's a good for a regular job, but it's very, it's way, way, way low for a TV job. So it was enough to keep me work, you know, like surviving without having it, enough to keep me drinking. Blew through that.
Keep the tap going.
Yeah. You know, so it was, you know, it was, I there wasn't any leftover. It was just enough to live, you know, in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You know what I find though, like now that I do stand up all the time, is when I know somebody that's around and they don't do stand up and then they start. It's like, motherfucker, you were wearing a wire that whole time.
I should have known.
Well, and I would see other comics say like, oh, this person. And then after having done it for a little while, I would see people kind of give that treatment to other people coming in. And I would always say, let them try it because it's fucking hard. And and if it's not in their soul, they're not going to keep doing it.
Yeah.
So let them fall on their face a bunch. Yeah. And if they are meant to do this, they'll keep doing it. And but the truth of the matter is most people are like, oh, this is not for me at all.
Oh yeah, this is very difficult.
I remember I had met Morgan Murphy. I went to a party and I met her and I overheard her saying she was doing stand up and I was like, oh, that's like something I've always wanted to do. And she's like, oh yeah, I've done a show with like Patton Oswalt. This is in 2002. And she was like, I've done a show with Patton Oswalt, one of these guys. I was like, oh my God, that's crazy. And then talked to her a bunch about it that night. And then the next time I saw her, I was like, I saw her at an open mic. And she kind of, and I know that feeling that she had, but it was just like, oh.
Yeah. So no, I know. It's a weird thing. We're like, oh, because people did it to me from like, I was a doorman and Louis, Marin, Sarah, all these guys knew me as a doorman. And then it's like, oh, motherfucker, what?
Yeah.
Like, and it's hard to see, even people that work like at clubs that start doing it and they become good. It's impossible not to see them as
you should have shown up. You should have shown up in a big crazy red wig.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's an odd feeling because everyone's going to always, you know, and that's a weird thing about starting really young in a scene where you're in front of everybody you're going to be around with the rest of your career. Is everyone's going to see you, you know, at 19 trying to do a bit and fucking it up. And then they'll like the 5 years later, you might have gotten really good, but they'll be like, yeah, I saw that kid once.
Oh, he fucking sucked. Yeah, I don't know. And then the compliment people go like, dude, you're so much better than you were. You could just say I'm good. You don't have to couch it as.
Yeah.
What I ultimately came to realize was that none of that shit matters. I was just like, well, you know, they're either going to like it or not, but I'm not going to stop doing it. And I went back and did, you know, I would do all the open mics I could, and then people would be like, why are you here? You can go anywhere. Because I'm like, because I'm not good enough yet.
Yeah, and the other thing is you can't go anywhere. That's people would say that to me too, like, what do you, go home. And do what?
Yeah.
What do you want me to do at home? Dude, you got money. Yeah, so what? Like, Lord. What do you want me to do?
Am I supposed to do single down in my living room?
Yeah, am I still supposed to just like, not like, you shut up. Desire to do stand-up, you sit there.
Yeah.
We're gonna watch a fucking movie for the next. Yeah, it's like, you, if you want to do it, you want to. And it's also not, it's a lot of, it's like misery. It's not like this life, not misery, but it's humiliating, certainly.
Sure.
And it's not like you go from, no one just dives in and it's like great, they were great from day one.
Yeah.
Well, it's very it's a vulnerable profession for people who are already insecure.
Yeah.
And so it's a strange, I mean, it's essentially like getting naked on stage every night. And then, you know, I sort of liken it to if a stripper were on stage and people were like, your tits are weird.
Yeah.
You know, your vagina's strange.
And I'm sure that never happened.
Yeah.
You know, and you sort of feel that like I'm exposed and I'm not doing, I'm not doing the thing.
And the other thing, if you're coming from another like thing, whether it's what I was doing or what you were doing, is people enjoy rejecting you.
Oh yeah.
Your peers really enjoy, like, no. I've had people say awful things to me that I would never say to anyone. It's like, yeah, you, I guess you can.
Well, I was lucky in that the open mic scene here that I fell into was really supportive and it was really nice, and it was, you know, it was this scene that Robin Jones and Vance Sanders and that was, you know, Zach was a part of that. Zach Galifianakis and Maria Bamford and Posehn and Patton and all these guys would. It was a really. I felt like we were all kind of similarly minded people, and they were really sweet and cool. And so I didn't really feel it was not. It wasn't what I think of as, you know, like a real competitive in the sense of like, it, when I say, you know, like, you know, Marin, that's when I would go back east. And right. It was like New York comics that were always a little...
Leather jacket. Maron said to me out here, he goes, what happened, Brennan? You didn't save your money? Okay. Just fucking trying to do stand-up. Like, it's not like I'm getting a massage.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do stand-up, man. It's not like an easy thing. Like, are you... Yeah, it's just weird. Which and that's just one guy that I just... You know what I mean?
I'm here to get accolades.
What's funny about that is that with you, I mean, at least with me, I could understand people like, you're a television host. Why are you doing stand-up? But you wrote with Chappelle.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you wrote for Chappelle.
Yeah.
So you obviously, it's not like you were doing something not like stand-up.
Yeah, like, I'm totally different than what
this line producer. Yeah.
I just, you just weren't saying the words in a lot of instances.
Yeah. Yeah, but they just, people have resentments.
How did you fall in with Dave, and how did it?
We had been friends before I met you when I lived in New York. He was like the only. We were both. I was working the door. I was going to NYU Film School, working the door at a comedy club, and then the only other young guy was Jay Moore and Chappelle, and I was roommates with Jay. Not a good roommate, if you can believe it. Alyssa Milano, my heart goes out to you. and then me and Dave just kind of hit it off, and then it was like 92, and then I was doing shit out here, and it was like, hey, he was doing shit, and then I wrote a script that got to this guy Bob Simons, who had produced like Sandler's movies, and I had a meeting with him. My script wasn't good, but I had a meeting with him. I was just fucking funny in the meeting. Just like one of those, you know, when you're like, I got a hot hand right now. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those, like, a really opportune time to be really funny. And then Chappelle went in like a week later on unrelated business. And they're like, do you have any ideas? And he's like, yeah, I'm writing a weed movie. They're like, what are you talking about? And he's like, yeah, with a buddy of mine. And they're like, who? And he goes, literally, you've never heard of him. Trust me. Like, you never, you trust me. And they were like, who? And he goes, Neil Brennan. And they're like, we not fucking love Neil. He's just here. Wow. You guys got to do this. So then Chappelle calls me and goes, hey, man, if anyone from Universal calls, tell them we're writing a weed movie. We'd never talked about writing a weed movie ever. I mean, ever. So then Universal called and I was like, yeah, we're writing a weed movie. And they're like, when can you come in? I was like, when? In 1 month. So then we had a month to come up with the movie. We took the full 30 days, started on day 29, and outlined it at the Mondrian the night before we had to pitch it. He had a room at the Mondrian. And I remember like the Sky Bar just opened and it was just like this pull. And we're like, no, we can't go down there. We have to work. And then we outlined Half-Baked, and then the next day we pitched it, and it was like, and then it was fucking spinning Variety covers after that. It was just like, we sold it in March, and we were shooting in July. And people kept going like, this never happens. They go, this so never fast. Happens. We were like, we'll see about that. This is nothing to us. A couple 23-year-olds. We outlined this thing in our sleep.
Oh, shit.
And then...
this isn't hard.
Yeah, fucking what are you talking about? And then the movie got mauled because we just didn't know how to like, control shit. We literally didn't. And now whenever somebody gets a movie that like asks me, I go like... Directing movies, it's your Indiana Jones, and the movie is the giant ball. And you have to have your hand on the ball before it starts rolling. Because if you don't, it's chasing you.
Oh, wow.
And that's what happened to us. Like, we just didn't know. And literally nothing about the movie was what we thought. The creepiest part was me and Dave walked on set in Toronto, and we're in some set, and he, like a couple mobsters, he goes, hey, like lock, not moving his mouth. He goes, is this how you saw the sets? And I go, I go, nope. And he goes, me neither. And then it was just a matter of managing the misery. It was just a weird thing. And then, you know, and then we kind of had beef after that. Not beef. It was just one of those things of like, we had a miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when parents lose a child, they get divorced a lot of the time. We got divorced. And then I wrote a couple movies just on my own, and sold them. And I lived in New York and had like a career. And then And then we sort of got warmed up to each other again. And then it was like, hey, we should do like a Playboy After Dark. And I was like, all right. And then it became Chappelle Show. And that was like a whole nother, that was a complete reaction to Half Baked in terms of like, oh no, every pair of pants will go through us.
Oh wow.
Like, and that's why, like, when people say, well, first of all, we wrote it all ourselves. Like, we would take outside pitches. Brian Tucker had a bunch of good pitches. Kroll and Birbiglia actually pitched the Nigger Family sketch, which was like a classic, but they pitched it in a different way. But I didn't know. I knew Kroll a little bit. But that was a reaction to, we write all ourselves. Chappelle told Conan that. Conan goes, who are you writing the show with? He goes, just a buddy of mine. And he goes, anybody else? He goes, no. And Conan goes, don't do that. and we were like, we got this. And then so we just fucking control everything, and which is great, but it's really exhausting.
Oh, it's. Yeah. I mean, it's almost impossible to do everything.
Yeah, sit in on every aspect
because
of
you
a production.
Can't. You only have so much brain energy.
Yeah,
and you have to really focus on what, not having to just like Atlas.
Yeah,
the whole thing.
But there was no the two of us were able to do it to a point. like we were able to do it, and it was like it was unbelievable. I wouldn't sleep for days, literally for days. I would just have to edit because we'd finish shooting, and then we'd have a taping. We'd finish shooting on like a fucking Friday, and then the next Wednesday would be like a taping.
Oh,
geez. So I would have
to.
No, we do it in blocks.
Okay,
so we do like three episodes at a time. So then it was like we'd shoot fucking 8-9 sketches, and then it was up to me to edit them and get them to it was literally like broadcast news of just like, here's the tape.
Yeah.
Run it up.
So you really understand why Louis wants to take a year off.
Oh, yeah. Fuck. I mean, unbelievably so. Like, to the point where it was so hard. Chappelle told me, it reminded me of a story recently where I'd done a cut of Rick James. It was like the first thing I was allowed to direct nominally, and I'd done a cut of it, but I just couldn't. I didn't have time to. It was like not going to be for a later up. It wasn't going to air for a while, so I just wanted to see if any of it worked. And it was like a cut of it, and it was doing okay. And Chappelle looks at me, and he's like, "You couldn't edit all of it?" And I looked at him, I go, "Sorry, man." And he said it was the most fucking loaded pointed, like, you fucking dickhead, get the fuck away from me, like, I haven't slept in 4 days, like, yeah. Why are you doing this? But that was the whole thing. So even when it got popular, it was I would hear about it way more than I would experience it. Like, like when it got popular, I would hear like, oh, I was at the fucking, I remember the thing that did it. Someone was like, yeah, I was in Las Vegas at a craps table, and somebody said, I'm Rick James, bitch.
Oh, wow.
And my first thought was like, why would anyone say that?
Was it Rick James that
yeah,
said
it was
that?
Like, literally, because he was alive then. It was like, I literally thought like, why would anyone say it that wasn't Dave or Rick James? And I'm still not sure. And then shit like that where I'd hear about it like on the outside, but I never got laid from it. I was just busy doing it.
That was your experience, and what was his experience?
His experience was I think similar, but he was getting inundated with Hollywood offers. Like, he was getting inundated with like literally anything you want to do. Like, and so he would like, here's a good example. Like, maybe toward the end of the second season, we went to Eddie Murphy's house. That in and of itself is the fucking best, but that's the whole story. So we went to Eddie Murphy's house, and this will make you insane. We didn't know if we were going to do a third season, and Eddie said, he goes, hey, why don't we should do like a sketch movie? He's like, Dave, you and I can be in it. and you got Neil and Dave can write it. Neil, you can direct it. And that day, my agent had told me no one was going to hire me as a director. Because they were just like, and then I got nominated for an Emmy for Rick James and all this shit. And then it was like, oh, no, yeah. But it was prior to that, it was like, it was Dave was getting, which fine. I don't, you know what I mean? I just wasn't attuned to like, I was too busy to even care. And the other thing is, you get these scripts, you get like piles of scripts and you go like, I'm super bad. Literally, you just, it's a pile of scripts. It's like, Blades of Glory, Super Bad.
What was the movie you did though?
The Goods.
The Goods.
Yes.
Yeah.
Blades, but there's just piles of them. You just go, and that's literally like, meh, that seems as good as any of them.
Yeah.
But and you don't know like, oh, Judd is coming. Like I didn't live out here, so I'd hear like this guy Judd Apatow and fucking this guy and Steve Carell on the on. I'd be like, I don't know.
Wow.
So yeah, or like
what happened with the Eddie Murphy thing? What happened with the Eddie Murphy?
Nothing.
Oh.
We ended up not doing the, although Eddie Murphy had a fucking hilarious idea for a sketch, which is he was talking about, he's like, you know how they make these like made for TV movies and it's always like a guy murdering prostitutes? He goes, what if there was one about a guy murdering pimps? Which is just a fucking, and then Chappelle had a line, which is a pimp goes to the police station and says, how many pimps must die before you people will do something?
That's great.
So there was, it was always like, it was hard to know what the fuck was going on. But he was getting inundated with like, literally every offer in the world.
Is it weird or scary at that point when you sort of feel like a lot of your livelihood depends on this other guy?
Oh, well, that's the whole thing is like, so he's getting all these offers and then people say like, you and Neil will do it. And he's like, fuck Neil. Meaning like he wants that. It's like, this is his time.
Yeah.
It's his, like he's been working since he was a kid, like I wanted to. So then it became a matter of like the attention thing makes it like he wants all the attention for himself. I was happy to work with him. Like I was happy to like write for him, whatever. But he just wanted to have his own stream of like attention and accolades. And that was problematic long term. But I don't blame him. Like, I get it. Like, I get why he would want that. But from my point of view, I was like, dude, we're fucking robbing the bank. Like, what the fuck do I, you know what I mean? Yeah. But he wanted his own sort of, he didn't like the team aspect, I don't think.
It was really interesting. It's always been interesting for me. And this is part of being in the business for so long. But then, you know, people you know when you're young and all of a sudden they're having like adult problems and they're saying it's like, oh, Dave Chappelle just flipped out and they're interviewing Neil. And I'm like, Neil, what the fucking crazy?
Is he leaning in the interview? Yeah, no, it is like, wait, what? Like Jenny McCarthy has an opinion on autism. What? Yeah, no, it is weird. It's a crazy, but that's also the thing of like, it's partnerships are hard, man. I mean, like overall, like it's just a hard balance. Jonah's giving me the death stare right now.
What are you
now,
looking at? What are you talking about?
They are, but we make it work.
Oh, this isn't a partnership. So, no, I'm kidding.
That's part of the fun.
It is a party.
Like my partner would say that, and he wasn't kidding.
Well, I think we're also, you know, even if we ever get a little like prickly about stuff, it's almost always like, oh man, are you okay? I mean, like we're all such caretakers and we're all such, and I think maybe that's because we're older and we're not like young and cocky.
Yeah, I mean,
in that way.
We were both 33. I mean, at that point, it's more just a character thing where it's not even, it's like characterological. It's like that. And that's why the last 8-9 years has just been me like, all right, well, I can't really rely on somebody.
Yeah.
As anything.
Does it make you not trust people or just that situation?
It makes me not trust black people.
I mean,
no, I don't know if it makes me not trust people. I'd still love to be in a good partnership. Like I love writing with people. It's fun. It's fun hanging out. It's fun fucking around. Like
I hate writing alone.
I know. And I always say it's like fishing by yourself. It's like if you can go with somebody, it just makes the misery that much more bearable.
Well,
so,
I just feel like having another brain buzzing in the room just activates it. Just activates it, that thing.
And there's a social thing, like on camera. Dave was really good. The reason he's really good in Rick James is because there were 40 women there. And there's just a weird thing of like
he's performing for them.
If there's people around, you will. And I find that with writing, if you have someone around that you want to impress, that helps. So you don't pitch garbage,
right?
You're not like, nah, it's close enough.
So it has to be kind of a mutual appreciation.
Yeah, you have to. You have to have a shared standard.
Yeah,
and then try to. Like, not bring garbage to the table. And then when they bring something, you, like, try to top it. Like, that was somebody, I think Dave one time said that he and I were, like, thrill killers, where he'd be, like, stabbing a guy, and I'd be like, chop his fucking head off, bro. You got, and he'd be like, chop his head off. Chop his fucking head off, brother. so, like, that's the, I like writing with people. But it's hard writing. It's hard to know. It's like, how long do you need to know somebody before you know how they're going to react?
Sure.
And it's hard. I don't know what the length of time is before you know how they're going to respond in every situation.
Well, what I saw happen with that show, and what I guess may have happened, maybe you know, and you can correct me, but it sort of feels,
I bet I know.
You probably know. But I think, you know, when you're a young comic, you know, you can be super subversive and you can kind of be a little invisible and you can still say whatever you want. And then at a certain point, you know, it's like, oh, everyone's watching you now. And now they're giving you a lot of money. So there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of, and it better be good and you better not do this. And so I can see that the pressure would feel probably like.
It's not fun. It becomes like, I remember we did a sketch where it was like, there was a thing where it was like, black people should vote. It was like, it was a game show and it was black people should vote. And Chappelle goes like, that's incorrect. Like about how to improve their lives. And then someone on CNN was like, Dave Chappelle said black people shouldn't vote.
Oh.
And it was just
no.
Motherfuckers. Could we, it was a goddamn comedy sketch.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it happened to Chris Rock a little bit with the niggas versus black people thing where it was like, it was a great bit that, because so many white people saw it, they thought like, see, our racism is justified. And
right.
It's like, you can turn it that way, but that wasn't the point of that bit. The point of the bit was that you're treating all black people as one type of one monolithic person. And there are, please differentiate.
Right.
Yeah.
And whereas people don't want to see nuance. So it became a thing of like, and also there's a thing with when you're a black artist, if white people like it too much,
then yes,
it you start to think maybe you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, I'm assuming that it's as the whitest person in the world talking about what it's like for black comics. But I mean, I'm assuming that, you know, when white people are laughing really hard and like, he said that word, he said, and then I imagine Dave must be like, I think people are not laughing for the right reason.
Yeah, but here's the thing. There's no group of people that are always laughing for the right reason. You know what I mean? It's just a matter of how much can you tolerate of the wrong, I don't know. It's definitely nuanced and complicated, and it's not I think the only solution is to just ignore it. That's what that was my take. I mean, obviously it's way easier for me to be like, fucking ignore it.
Yeah.
Black guy, come on, we got this. You're famous and I'm totally invisible and it's fucking, but it was easy. I was sort of always encouraging, like, just let it rip, man. Like, what are you? So then it became before he went to Africa, it became this thing of like, what was the right type of sketch and what was the right, it just became this like weird game of like nothing, everything felt racist and it just became like not fun. It was fun like writing and shit. It was still really funny, but it just became like this weird game. It just became not, it was not fun in that regard where it, when you start parsing laughs or start going like, how So what percentage of people will be laughing for the right reason?
Yeah.
Like a good example was we were after the blind white supremacist sketch. Some guy came up.
It's one of the best sketches.
No, it's an awesome. Yeah. It's fucking awesome sketch. So some guy comes up. We were at a bar or something in Arizona of all places, and some like real dusty red motherfucker comes up and goes like, I like that one sketch about the guy who left his wife because she's a nigger lover. And we were just like, we're both like, is that what you took from that? Like, is
they said that to Dave? He said that to Dave?
Yes.
And how did Dave respond?
We both just were like so chilled by it that it was just like, ugh.
So that would have to fuck with your psyche a little
bit. Yeah, it fucks with your psyche. It just eats away at you where you're like, how do you do this shit in a way that's... I think Chris has backed off. Like, he said, not like he regrets niggas for black people, but it was like he feels some remorse about it. He feels remorse about the way people responded to it. And it's fucking not fun. You know what I mean? Like, and then your arc, it's like Pryor's arc where he's like, you know, I went to Africa and I'm never going to say the N-word again and all this stuff. It's like, okay. Apparently Mooney told me he said it off stage more than ever. That's the fucking hilarious part.
Really?
Absolutely.
That's great.
He said like, oh, and he goes, and by the way, Richard never made more money than after he said that. He goes, oh, white people love that. As soon as they heard that, they were like, so there's always like a richer story to it. And that's, again, why I kind of adore Eddie Murphy. It's because he never really fell into that trap of like, how black am I and how white am I and how, not how black and how white, but like Eddie's jokes were never that racially, you know, potent. Mm-hmm. That kind of wasn't his thing.
Yeah.
But even, you know, there's stuff in Coming to America, like you could make a case that the sexual chocolate scene is like making fun of black church and all this shit. And it's like, or you could just go, shit's funny.
Yeah. He's just doing a ridiculous character that's an amalgam of a bunch of guys that were swimming around in his head.
Yeah.
And then it's not really a grand statement on anything. It's like, oh, just this character, like, you know.
Yeah. Or the Mr. White sketch where he put the white makeup on and it's a fucking unbelievable. That's like one of my, my favorite sketch ever.
I realize white people give each other things.
Here, take this for free. Do you remember that Garrett Moore sketch? I can't remember who the other guy was, but it was like a guy that was talking about the differences of people in black people. He's like, well, it really turns out that lighter skinned black people are smarter than darker skinned black people. And it was just
Garrett was just sitting there.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
He's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And the guy's like, no, it's a proven fact. Just trying to like usurp some supremacy over the guy.
That show was real edgy back then.
Yeah.
Like really like
the Chevy Chase, Richard Pryor.
Yeah, Chevy Chase, Richard Pryor. Yeah.
Mooney wrote that.
Mooney wrote that?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah. He like, that's true. That's like fact. Because he was with Pryor.
Oh my God.
That's a great sketch.
Yeah.
Just the way they just keep on like digging in. Before saying each of the phrases.
Well, they also did Pryor apparently hated Chevy.
Oh, really?
Like, fucking hated his, just like a visceral hatred. Because if you're a black dude, Chevy's like a country club dude, I think. Which you don't realize. You go, oh, yeah, he is like that sort of bluff, like fucking, like that kind of like superior smug thing.
White shorts and a polo shirt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like that superior, like fletched, like,
But fortunately, he let that go and never had any problems again.
Yeah, he's been great.
Just the worst things hearing about this in the community. I never heard. No one ever said, you know, there's this really funny thing that Chevy said once on the set of Community.
Yeah.
There's just, everyone just looks like they, I mean, no one will really talk about it. There's just always like a, there's a little bit of PTSD.
Yeah. Well, that's, have you heard the fuck you Chevy story?
No.
The Harmon story?
No.
Well, like, he actually had everyone at the rap party say, fuck you, Chevy.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah. That was, like, the big 2 years ago or whatever. Like, he had them chant, fuck you, Chevy. The whole crew. And Chevy walked out. Because he wouldn't... It was a whole... I heard the whole story. It was, like, about it's whatever. But, yeah, apparently he's not a great guy.
Yeah.
So it's harder. It's a pain in the... It's just another pain in the ass responsibility that black dudes have to bear. That white comics never have to bear. Just like, am I the spokesman? Chris Rock was the spokesman for black people for 7 years.
Yeah.
And then Day became the spokesman.
Well, because people, you know, particularly with comedy, they'll usually have room for like one or two comics mm-hmm. to categorize in their brain. So they'll go, okay, this is the white comic that I know, and that is the
right,
black comic that
it's
I know.
The, with white guys, there's so many subcategories.
Yeah.
Whereas black dudes, there's one. Now it's Kevin Hart. But Kevin's not political, but it's like there's just one. Whereas with white people, it's like Bill Maher, Jon Stewart, Daniel Tosh, Ray Romano, Jim Gaffigan. There's like a
why is the disparity so unfair? Is it a numbers thing? It's like, well, there's 300 million
like
white
people. They don't know. I think because there's 14% black people in the country. So it's like there's more. I think there's just white people have one. They just like one guy.
Or people in general maybe just have room in their brain one person.
Yeah, but having said that, they have room for a lot of white people.
That's true.
Yeah.
So it's like Jay Leno, Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, fucking your show. Yeah. It's like there's
but get W. Kamau Bell out of here.
Yeah. There's like a slew of and there's also not like there's one black voice, but in terms of like from white people's point of view, they can't. Like, they wouldn't know the difference between Kamau Bell and Dave. Or Kamau Bell and anybody else.
Someone should scoop Kamau up and just put him on a bigger...
He was great.
They should just put him on a bigger... I wish they would just put him on a bigger platform. Like,
yeah.
I mean, FXX. Hey, let's start this whole channel at a time where people aren't really watching cable channels.
That was a rough move.
Yeah, that was a real bad move.
Yeah, bro. Hey, FXX, you fucked up, bro. Chop his fucking head off, brother.
See you in a couple weeks, FXX. Have a great pitch.
So now it's the coming back from... It's my own, like, personal last bunch of years. It's just been, like, trying to differentiate myself, but, like, just what can I do on my own, which is why I do stand-up so much. And I'm doing a couple pilots, and it's, like, figuring out... You know, I spent a lot of time, like, trying to find somebody. It's like I did the Piven movie and it was like maybe Adam and Will want to I'll be like one of the funnier die click or like maybe I'll be with Judd or and I no one was I just didn't it didn't happen and so now it's like because everybody's kind of got a click and then I realized that pretty quickly when I was like why am I so alone so now it's like just do shit on my own.
Are you gonna continue to try and direct more movies?
No, they don't want me to. I mean, they won't let me. I've written a couple that I will direct if they ever go anywhere.
But even like at a smaller scale, like just kind of go and try and do it on your own.
Yeah, but that at this point, what I've realized is like you have to make. It's like people. It's a real pass fail thing. It's like a movie has to be fucking perfect.
Yeah.
For people to like. Movies are so even just marketing it's like no you have 48 hours for this shit to fucking work and you better pick the right star and the right story and you better get lucky and you better have great marketing
and
they better do
the right
good
time.
Proofs and it better be the right month and you better not open against Half-Baked open against Titanic
but
that's a bad example
but Half-Baked like became a cult hit
I'm
sure at the time that didn't.
Yeah, that didn't. It was they weren't like, hey, this guy writes cult hits, so we're gonna get our money back in 12 years.
So bad. Hang on a sec.
Yeah.
I'll be right back. And then I'm so sorry.
Do you want us to stop talking,
Chris?
You can keep talking if you want. I just have to pee. So bad.
Yeah. So you gotta. It's just.
So you wouldn't want to go for a smaller like. It's like I am just not like
it's
not an indie
be
movie.
So perfect. And also, look, I wrote a movie like a romantic comedy that. Montecito bought like Ivan Reitman's company like 5 years ago and then been trying to get that made and then I just finished a script for Kevin Hart hopefully.
Yeah. Do you sell scripts do you try to get you know the add-on that you'll direct it as well?
Yeah. So I directed Schumer's show, I directed The New Girl, I directed Mindy, like I do still direct stuff.
Yeah.
But like they're so it's so like no, we didn't fucking like that movie, so fuck you. And it's like, did you not like the writing? What is there? The forensics are so bad.
Yeah, it's basically that idea of just, no, I saw that guy at a second open mic. He's horrible.
I saw that guy at a second open mic, and he can't do it.
Yeah, no matter what he's done since.
Yeah, it's we're just talking about how like the pass-fail thing of like, you just, the goods didn't do well, so, and people don't watch it, and then, or they just go, I didn't like it. We go, what didn't you like about it? The writing or was it badly directed? Was it, and people are so sort of simple-minded that they can't do forensics on it. They can't go like, this didn't work, that worked, that
well,
didn't, that didn't.
Because there's too much pulling for people's attention and they just don't want to devote. And also it's, you know, as a comic, you can, you know, you can fuck up and then people are like, oh, that guy's not funny. But if you start writing, I mean, I always felt like, if you figure it out, you can still change people's minds.
Yes.
But with a movie, it's such a long process.
Yeah, it
and
takes
there's so much
long.
Involved. But with stand-up, it's be like, hey, look, here are my jokes. Oh, you guys kind of funny.
I have new jokes. And they go, that old opinion is dumb. I mean, you were saying that people still do have a bias. I agree with you.
Yeah.
So I just do shit. I'm doing pilots and
that's great.
See what happens.
When I'm sure you've talked about this a ton, so I apologize. But when Dave got the big, like, here's 50, you know, we'll give you $50 million to come back, and he said no that whole time, were you like, just why? What?
He didn't say no. He said yes, and then I got it, and then I got like my own deal, and then we did the show, and then he left. So, but I still got. I still did good.
Oh, okay.
But it's not cold comfort, but it's like definitely not, it's not what I wanted. You know what I mean? Like I wanted to keep doing the show. Look, guys, Neil Brennan doesn't like to get paid for nothing.
That's what you gotta know about Neil Brennan.
Yeah, let me tell you something.
Because I saw him after, I ended up accidentally opening for him.
Oh, did you really?
At the Punchline, because he just, you know, he would just, do this kind of spur of the moment residency, and he would say like, "Oh, I want to do this." And they go, "Okay," and then I was supposed to be headlining, and I just ended up opening for him for a couple shows, which I was totally fine with.
Yeah,
and he talked about it a bit, and he was like, "How did you turn down $50 million?" He was like, "Cause I got 10 in the bank." You know, it was like that sort of a. He did like 4 hours.
Yeah,
he had like a 4-hour set, which was actually engaging.
Yeah,
for 4 hours.
Yeah,
but it seemed that. You know, it kind of seemed like he didn't want any of that stuff. It seemed like he just didn't want any of it.
I think the responsibility thing was a pain in the ass, and then the doing the show was hard. Like it was really hard. And then maybe he didn't like that sort of like level of fame. You think you like it, and then. Although now he's actually even more famous and he doesn't seem to bother him. Mm. He's so fucking, it's so miserable to be around him. Like it's so, people like Will, I saw him in Santa Monica a couple months ago when we were getting coffee and we were sitting outside and he's a magnet for fucking lunatics. I've never seen anything like it. Like, literally, like I said, you're like a fucking wishing well where people just go up and stand around them.
Oh, jeez.
Like, fucking get ice cream and just eat it near them. just like, I swear to you, this is how crazy magnet he is. We're sitting outside in Santa Monica. A black homeless guy walks up to him, hands Dave $20. And says, come on, nigga, we got work to do. And it was like, that's the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. And that was just one of the things that happened.
Oh, Jesus.
So I don't think he might. I don't know. I honestly, like, I. It's hard to say. I mean, it's a multifaceted thing. It's not just one thing. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess if you just want to do stand up and then all this other crazy shit comes with it. I mean, it. I don't know. I don't know if I would want to be in a situation where, you know, you're performing in a giant venue and you're just trying to, like, do what you're supposed to do and people are just shouting at you. You're like, okay, please, stop. Yeah. You know, which it seems like that really kind of...
Yeah, but now he does it, and he's figured out a way to just tell people to not do it.
Isn't it funny that when guys, it must be a kind of a soul-crushing experience, because you guys did 2-3 seasons?
Two and a third.
And then it was like, you know, he didn't want to do anymore. Louis does a few seasons, like, I got to take a break. Flight of the Conchords did 2 seasons, yeah. And they were like, yeah. So like 2-ish seasons is right about where you go.
Because the thing is, it's like you're not, because I've had other offers to do other shows, and like, it's like, I'm not curious after a while. It's like, Rock said to Dave, he goes like, yeah, now you know you can do that. Now you're curious, like, can I do something else? Like, you run, it's like, oh, okay, I can do that. You're curious about it. Like, I wonder if I could have a show and get super popular and all that stuff. And then you go, oh, I can. And then you not, like, lose interest, but it's like, you don't have anything to prove to yourself other than, like, can I maintain this lead?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which isn't as much fun as, like, being the underdog and people going, like, I remember, like, I think it was the night before the first episode aired, we were at a concert, and some black kid came up to Dave and goes, like, yo, man, what are you going to do? Because you're too white for black people and too black for white people. And it was like, okay, nice to meet. So it's just like this. So then, like, prove all that wrong, and then so you prove it wrong. It's funny, like, with stand-up, I've had a similar experience where people were like, we don't think you can draw on the road. And I was like, I think I can draw on the road. Just give me a door. Like, give me a deal where... And so I spent, like, 2 years on doing road gigs. And it was like, fuck you guys. Like, you didn't think I could do this. And at one point, I'm, like, in line at the TSA with my hands. And it's, like, 6 in the morning. I'm like, you didn't think Neil Brennan could stand in line. And then I'm like, who am I doing this for? Like, at what point do you just go, yeah. When you're acting as a response to somebody else, it's just sort of like futile. We're like, what am I doing? I'm like literally traveling because you said I wouldn't.
I know, yeah. But there are so many. It's so difficult to gauge in this business in particular because it's so nonlinear. I mean, it can be linear, but there are so many facets to it. How do you judge? What's your feedback for? I'm doing it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it can be, no one showed up at this thing, or people showed up at this thing, or there's no show on the air. There's a show on the air, or these people are interested, or the phone's not ringing. Like,
yeah.
How do you really, it's like we're constantly searching for approval, not just for our own narcissism, but also like, am I doing good so I know that if the thing I care about is advancing?
Yeah.
Or am I not advancing? Like, it just doesn't.
Should I alter what I'm doing?
It doesn't work. It doesn't really work in a way that's easy to read or is measurable.
It's also, you're like someone, I got a special airing January 18th on Comedy Central. And someone in an interview, they go, so what level of fame would you be happy with? I was like, I'm going to guess wrong. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'm never going to go like, you know whose fame I really, I don't fucking know. It's like, it's not like a jacket you can put on. It's like a really weird, undefinable, like, do you like the amount of fame you have, Chris? Like, what's the right amount of fame?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely feel like, I've worked long enough and people are very nice to me in public when they know who I am and they're respectful and enough people say, hey, nice job, that I feel like, okay, I've done, you know, a version of what I thought I was wanted to do. And but it's not so bad that it's like, oh, the paparazzi,
yeah,
here they come, like, no one gives a shit, you know, like, all, like, enough
that's
people,
the nice pocket.
Enough people care, but not, but overall, no one really gives a shit. So it's
not inconvenient.
It's not no, and I don't really feel like if I do something that the press is gonna go, can you once again, Hardwick puts his foot in his, like,
yeah, someone's gonna get famous for just getting offended at some point. They're just gonna be like the offended person.
Yeah,
they're gonna blow up from that, from like blogs, and then I couldn't believe that. Yeah,
well,
so.
I think that, you know, if you're so under the microscope like Chris Rock or any of the big comics where you really have to just drop in on a club unannounced so you can practice some jokes so that you can – I mean, like, I feel like those guys have less leeway to fall on their face a little bit because people are going to be like, ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this guy's not so funny. I saw him. Wasn't that great? And then, yeah. And then that person, you know, immediately just forms a judgment based on, no, this is part of the process.
Yeah.
And
I mean, Rock says when he goes on at the Cellar, like, lower your expectations. Like, he goes, you haven't paid enough money for this show. Like, I'm not going to kill for $12.
That's
it's like, he goes, if I'm going to kill, you're going to pay $12 for parking. It's funny, dude.
Yeah, he's good. He's good.
But I totally understand why guys like Eddie Murphy don't go back and do stand-up, because it's just too...
Yeah, I mean, you can make the... Yeah, it's like, I've seen Eddie talk about it. It's like, man, everybody's got phones and shit. Like, I can't be fucking with that. Yeah. And it's like, it is a problem, but if you really want to do it, you know.
That's why, yeah. I think it ultimately, everything always has to be about... what are we at, Katie?
An hour 15.
Okay. 15? Oh, good. It has to be about the work. No matter where the peaks and valleys in your career are, as long as you're focused on the work. If you're focused on the attention stuff, that's always going to come and go.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've been through many iterations of it, but as long as I kind of have this idea in my head of, especially if stuff gets turbulent or whatever.
Well, that's what's nice about aging, is like you just go, oh, I've been through this. I've been through this storm before.
Yeah, I think of it like, and I'm not a surfer, but I think of it like, here comes a wave, I'm just gonna duck down and
duck dive.
I'm gonna, essentially I think of it as that. It's just like a duck dive. I'll duck dive, and when I'm duck diving, it's just about the work. I'll just focus on the work, and hopefully
the next set comes.
And hopefully it'll you know.
I heard Bruco's got some sweet waves, guys.
They're gone. It's done.
I know.
Bruco's done.
That's the thing about, you just go like, yeah, you're hot, then you're not, and you just like kind of can't pay attention to it.
Yeah.
No. It's pain. It still hurts your feelings, but it's like, nah, it doesn't hurt as much as it did when I was 23.
Right.
Yeah.
Now it's like, eh, I'll be all right.
I met Stephen Wright in Vegas. Just, I saw him walking through a casino, and I saw him, and I stopped and talked to him, and he was going, it's like, yeah, it's so weird how people think I'm not doing anything anymore.
Yeah.
When I've been performing just as much as I ever have. It's just people's perception. They don't see me on TV, so they think I stopped doing comedy.
Yeah. That happens to Rock. Like, just because he hasn't had a TV show.
Or ever done a special?
Yeah, he just hasn't done a special in 4 or 5 years.
Like, well, was his last special the two city? Like,
three
cities.
Yeah.
South Africa, New York, and Detroit?
New York, South Africa, London.
London.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sort of like the, you know, he sort of does like the James Cameron thing where it's like, oh, you don't hear him. And then like, boom, he just does this really huge thing.
Well, he does this thing where he waits until there's like a new wave of culture to comment on. And he always like comes out just in time to just be like, this stuff that's happening and this and that. Yeah. So it's,
Louis' special a year thing, I thought, he's going to spread himself too thin. There are some things that I really just want him to, I mean, I have no say, but I, as a fan, I mean, like, I really want him to focus more. Like, I thought his last special was good. I'm like, oh, it's good, you know, and I love Louis.
It's fine. I mean, but, that's the thing,
I mean, his previous special, but this last one, oh my God, I thought was fucking phenomenal.
Yeah, I liked it.
I had a different opinion, but in terms of, it's really hard to work at that level. To work at that high a level for every year. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
And like, I tend to think that Chris is right, and he's got a new hour and something that's fucking great.
You mean Chris Rock?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I don't think comedy, stand-up comedy should be in the round.
You don't think so?
No. Especially when you have a cord and you're just constantly... Like, but there's like moments in that special where he's like, the cord is wrapped around his leg.
But I thought... why not go wireless? I that was probably an homage to the Carlin special.
Probably.
Because he's doing the Carlin track.
Yeah.
You know, so I just, maybe
but
that
Carlin
was
wasn't a one a year. His was like one every 2 years.
Yeah.
I can't imagine trying to have another separate career and still do one special a year. I mean,
can't write jokes that quickly.
I can't either.
That's the truth. As much as I'd love to go like... I've been saying, again, doing press for the special, I keep going. People are like, I go, look, I'm not a genius. I have to write jokes, and there's a high mortality rate of jokes just like, meh. just not good enough, and then you just try to. It just takes a while, and I there's a part of me that feels bad, yeah. like I'm not a genius. But then there's also like, I don't know, what am I going to do? Am I going to have a miserable life?
Yeah,
because four people can write jokes faster than me.
Yeah. Am I going to be Salieri my entire life?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Am I going to be like that fucking Bill Burr?
Yeah,
motherfucker. It's like no, I got to try to have a decent life.
Yeah,
and yeah, it's like what do you? Yeah, Bill Burr writes faster than me. Louis writes faster than me. But there's solace to be taken in other venues. Yes,
very true.
At what point in your relationship with Dave were you comfortable pitching jokes or sketches with the N-word in them?
Like, immediately. I mean, again, this is 92. We became friends, and that's, like, the peak of hip-hop. The peak of, like, hip-hop entering mainstream. So it was just constant and chronic, and literally chronic. And it just didn't. It never occurred to me not to, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, it's still, I don't do it around, I say to my act like 8 times, and it's not like...
Are people weird with it, or are they okay
with really.
It?
Not really, because the way I set it up in a way that, like, it. I talk about being called it, I talk about, like, and my, what do I do, and all that shit, so, and I never say it as me, and I'm never like, these, I never, like, yeah. So yeah, I don't, I guess I should... I don't know, because I just work with Chris on something, on his movie, pitched it fucking all the time. I called, literally, I'm in a scene, and he plays a baseball, this is like a, it's a long story, but he plays a baseball player, and it's like a sort of a Jackie Robinson thing, and I was the pitcher, and he's like, he goes, so yeah, call me nigger. I go, no, I'm way ahead of you. Like, oh, I was gonna call you nigger. You think I was gonna call you? We're doing a baseball movie. That's like the fucking.
That's why I.
What other weapon do I have as the white pitcher?
Then a spinoff movie. With you,
but I also DMX was in the movie, and I wanted him to say nigger, and I like whispered it to Chris. But I said it to Chris. Like, I don't give it. I just can't say the. There's something about the N word that I just find. I can't. I have some sort of code, although I couldn't explain it to you. It's like if there's old people in the audience, I won't say it. If there's old black people in the audience, I won't say it. Because it's like to them, it means something else. To me, it just means a dude.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it just means like a bunch of niggas. Like, it's literally just a bunch of dudes. Like, I don't even see it like that. And all bitches is kind of the same. I personally don't say bitches that much. But there was a time where it's like, man, I got this one bit. Like, if I'm hanging out, I'm not going to.
It was a part of your social.
It was a part of my social strata. It was a part of my social life and still is. Like, regularly, I get called it every single day. Every day.
By whom?
By the cops. No, no, I don't, like, by Dave or whoever texts me, fucking, yeah, like, I get called it to, hold on, I'm just seeing who called me that today.
What was today?
Yeah, like, Charlie Murphy texted me today, he didn't call me that, but he's been known to. Yeah, just, like, black dudes will say it.
So, out of context... If someone was like, hey, how dare, how could you say this? Or how could you, you know?
I don't go around looking for opportunity to say it.
Yeah.
It's like, I can say is like, when I say it, it's culturally appropriate. Maybe not, I can't explain it. Because I hear myself talking, I'm like, what are you talking about? But I just, the way I say it, for the most part, is the right times to say it.
Right.
And I don't say it around black dudes I don't know. I don't say it around old black people. I say it around people like my social life as an adult has mostly been immersed. And I'm also in a weird position where I'm expected to write it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's not a lot of guys that are, but I happen to be one of them.
Right. If you're working with Dave or Chris
Or whatever. It's like, I always say the N-word for black comics is like hamburger helper. Makes every joke a 15% funnier. Just like a little dollop of it, and you're gonna fucking little nice spice. Yeah, like it's just a little bit. It's like Rock said about Dave. It's like then where it's like nitroglycerin, like in the right dollop, perfect. Too much, it'll blow up in your face. But yeah. But like, me and Chris never talked about whether I could say it or not. It was just assumed that I would. Or maybe he's mad at me. I don't know. But I also don't think he thinks about it. Like, it's just like, yeah, I don't know, fucking Neil. That's what I don't think. I guess if black guys don't know me, they're like, what the? But if they know me, it's like, yeah, I don't know, Neil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't mean it. Literally, I've never said it in a negative way. Yeah. If that makes sense.
Well, I don't think anyone would say like that guy's racist. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
Like, knowing,
it's like, exactly.
Who
it's
you
like
are
okay. So okay,
from.
Go through my phone. Okay. Yeah. So where's the? Show me the racism. Show me my racist actions. I challenge you. Are you out there? I'm kidding.
So January 18th is your special,
and the name of the special is Women and Black Dudes. Because that's what my entire act is about.
I love that bit you have about how like white people need like noise machines and like sleep aids,
yeah,
stuff like that. And then
yeah, but that's the thing. Like it's about just when black dudes they just need like a bite of a sandwich to fall asleep.
I saw you said a bite of a sandwich in a moment of silence.
Yeah, a bite of a sandwich in a moment of silence. But like that's there's a point where I say like I've never met a black insomniac in my life.
That's right.
And
yeah.
That gets again. That's one of those forks in the road where. Racist white people think I'm saying black people are lazy. Mm-hmm. So I have to quickly go, meanwhile, every white person I know has sleep issues. Like, I have to make it into this differentiation thing that isn't, like, it's just weird. This shit, it's that thing of, like, I don't like saying it if there's too many white people, because it becomes like, yeah!
Because then
it becomes that guy in Arizona.
It becomes us and them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It becomes an Arizona thing. Like, that's the thing. It's like, it's almost like it's possible these differences are most the thing that me and Dave used to talk about on the show a lot was like most of what the racial problems in America or anywhere are just access. It's just you don't have access to black people, like for the most part. And white people, there are so many black people that because I talked to friends of mine that are athletes, there are guys that they play in professional sports with that haven't dealt with white people that much. That literally are fucking afraid or angry or have tension with white people. And it's like, spend 20 minutes with black people and you'll be cool. Just every once in a while. Just go. They'll be nice to you. Like, and same, I always encourage black people I say a thing. We have a podcast, me and Moshe, called The Champs, and it's mostly black guests. And I always say that black guys, every successful black guy I know, spent a lot of time with white people growing up because it just demystifies white people. And it's almost been 100% true of like Dave grew up in Ohio. Chris went to an all white school. Kanye spent a lot of time with white people. Damon Dash spent a lot of time with white people. Biggie spent a lot of time with white people. Puffy spent a lot of time with white people. Like all these guys had, that's one of the through lines that no one ever talks about. It's like the Malcolm Gladwell thing of just like, that's not the secret formula, but if they get it, it's just better for everybody.
Yeah.
And then white people get to go like, yeah, I knew this fucking guy. Yeah, it seemed fine. That's what you come away with. It's like, yeah, they're fine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like they're magic, because then it becomes this thing of like, they're magical. No, they're fine.
Well, yeah. It's, I mean, if people took more time to spend their energy connecting with other people on a human level and then not any other level, then mm-hmm. people would actually start to, there wouldn't be as many problems.
Well, it's funny because Emily, our friend, would say, you know, when she had a gay friend in high school, she would just never bring it up to the mom, but she would have that person hang out at the house a lot. And then she would mention it, you know, months down the line. It's like, oh, I really like your friend, you know, Sam. It's like, oh, you know, Sam's gay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
They're so nice and normal.
Yeah.
It's like she would just like kind of ease it. And now her parents are like the Southern, like just very, you know.
Well, that's what they said about gay marriage too, was like once you see that, like, it's just, they're just boringly married. They're not like on the front lawn fucking with fucking like leather chaps on and all. Yeah. They're just like, no, they're just like going to work and doing regular people stuff. It's not like, it's not all the gay pride parade.
Louis' joke about them touching dicks on the front lawn.
Yeah, right before you're about to eat
cereal. Yeah, and then they just touch dicks. Right? Oh, come on. I'm trying to. Two guys are blowing each other. I'm trying to mow there. It's not going to be even now.
Is that the gay marriage joke?
Well, his idea is that, you know, that people just sit around and they're just mad about gay people together. And it's like, it doesn't affect you.
Oh, yeah.
I would totally understand if you were having one of your cereal and then two guys just touch dicks right above your spoon. You're like, come on.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, I think we did it.
We really did.
I think we went and we did it.
Congratulations on all the success.
Thank you, buddy.
In addition to the special, I know you're doing a Comedy Central show too, right?
A pilot, yeah.
And you're doing a pilot, and then you sold another show, and I check up on you from time to time.
We're doing stuff.
That's good.
Hi, you guys. I heard you doing an impression of me. What are you going to be?
Was that Arsenio?
Yeah. Okay. I'm doing Arsenio Tuesday. Don't be jealous.
All right. And then your podcast, The Champs, with Moshe Kasher as well. Neil Brennan.
God bless.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Great.
Yeah.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.